The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
Spotify have always had fantastic user momentum.
Solar energy, the fastest growing corner of the energy market by far.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The talent wars are right around Wall Street, but the buy side is plucking up off the sell side.
Aldi was the fastest growing grocery chain in the United States last year.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Kriti Gupta, in for Alex Steele. Over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we look at how killer acquisitions in the tech and pharma space could continue this year.
Plus, the boom in AI is heating up and bringing new energy to cooling thematics.
But first, ESG is generating some of the renewable limelight this year, especially after 2022's global shocks. For more on what's in store for ESG, we're joined by Adeline Diab, Bloomberg Intelligence Director of ESG Research for the EMEA and APAC regions. Adeline, a pleasure to have you on the show. Talk us through the major themes in ESG for this year.
So, I mean, yes, definitely, as you just said, 2022 was definitely a big shock for ESG, and there was some greenwashing risk, and then the implication of the Ukraine-Russia war, etc., were quite did weigh on the industry. But it also helped sharpen the industry, and there are a few key topics. So first, we think that the ESG ETF flows, for example, are going to pick up. We've done some analysis, and we think that if gas fundamentals remain where they are, then the ETF flows will grow, since ESG ETF are underweight in energy, so hence that will be supportive. In addition, regulation is cleaning up the industry, and we are seeing that a stronger product offering is going to come out. And although it weighs on asset manager, it will be helpful for flows as well. And these are two trends. Obviously, the political environment is actually fueling ESG because of the green transition becoming all the more important. And interestingly enough, we're seeing the carbon price pick up and even being quite interesting relative to the oil price. So these would be a few major trends.
Adeline, what does it mean, or what's the impact with China reopening? I know Europe has such a strong trading relationship with China.
Unfortunately, China reopening, they announced an increase in coal output,
right,
which means more thermal power, so coal-generated power, to avoid power a crisis in China. So the government announced this increase, which means an expected 600 million additional carbon emissions that are going to come in the world. And such a volume represents as much as Canada's annual emission. So definitely China reopening, and with this news, is another reason why the green transition is very important, and we need to keep an eye on China's, despite their green intentions and investing in the green industries, they want to keep their power mix the same, and coal is definitely a big challenge.
Well, Adeline, a big part of the ESG makeup is a lot of tech shares, not just here from the States, but around the world. Talk us through a little bit of the kind of accounting that may or may not aid some of the rebounds you're seeing in ESG.
So accounting is very interesting. And Adani has definitely refocused investor attention to accounting quality. So we will see that governance is back on the agenda. And thanks to some analysis, that is financial analysis, you can definitely look at good versus bad accounting practices. We can look at anomaly detection. And I think this will definitely help investors. So, for example, in we've done an analysis in APAC on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. And historically, within the tech sector, companies with good accounting metrics versus those that have poorer accounting practices within that industry, there is a pair trade that is quite significant with 20% difference in terms of performance. And at the moment, the whole sector has traded slightly differently, but we see that there are opportunities driven by accounting, basically. Again, Adani crisis has put that on top of investors' mind, which is exciting. And another big trend this year, absolutely.
Adelaide, you got a chart in your research note here showing ESG ETF fund flows. Big drop off in 2022, and then you guys have it forecasted to grow again. Talk to us about what happened in 22 and what's the basis of your forecast?
So in 2022, basically the fact that oil fundamentals were very strong did weigh a lot on the ESG ETF flows because ESG ETF are generally underweight energy. So that was definitely one of the main driver for that. The second reason is that there has been a lot of greenwashing allegations. There was a surge of funds being labeled ESG that had nothing to do with it without any proper investment process. So two big drivers that weighed down on the entire industry. Now we are seeing tougher regulations coming in, which will help that. The oil and gas fundamental may still weigh slightly, but again, things are looking up, and over time, as the green transition, increases and fueled by the IRA again in the U.S., we see positive momentum for ESG ETF flows. And we have three scenarios, one that is kind of stable, and then definitely it could represent up to 10% on average of global ETF flows by 2030, and it has already peaked at 20% in 2021. So we think we are quite confident with our numbers.
That's a very fascinating take, certainly on the kind of rebound of ESG that we are seeing, not just here in the States, but around the world. Bloomberg Intelligence analyst Adeline Diab, we thank you, as always.
Let's stay on the topic of ESG investing with a focus on the ETF market. Joining us to discuss is Bloomberg's Intelligence Senior ESG Strategist, Shaheen Contractor. Shaheen, talk to us about fund flows into ESG ETFs. 2022, we saw a drop-off. What's your outlook going forward?
So, Paul, there are two things really that I'm watching. So first, you know, you're right, ESG ETF saw quite a bit of a drop-off in 2022, the first, I think, in a very long time. I think going forward, it's going to be interesting to watch the difference between Europe and the U.S. And our take there is Europe is going to continue to drive flows while the U.S. slows down a little bit. And just to paint a few numbers on that, so last year, the U.S. dropped 90%, ESG ETF flows dropped 90%, much more than the overall market, and Europe dropped slightly less than the overall market. So a lot of strength there in Europe. And the second trend that we're watching, or at least I'm watching, is concentration risk. And what that means is for a very long time, ESG has grown due to these large one-off allocations from investors. And that gives you, I want to say, a limited investor base. And just as a number, so 22% of flows went into 10 funds last year. And when there are 1,000 plus funds, that's a bit of a problem. So I'm watching to see if the investor base gets wider.
Well, Shaheen, I'm looking at your research here, and there's a sentence here that really catches my eye. U.S. ESG ETF 2022 flow share fell to 1%, yes, which is what you were just referencing, as Europe's grew to 86%. But I've got to ask, what factors may reverse that?
What factors may reverse that? Oh, boy. I don't know. I think in the U.S. it's going to have to be a little bit on the sentiment. It's going to have to be a little bit on regulation. I mean, Europe continues to drive ahead because it has favorable regulations. Take, you know, MiFID suitability regulations, for example. There, an advisor has to ask an investor now if they have ESG preferences, which is what could drive more flows? I think it's regulation.
How about new funds? Are there new ESG funds being launched? And how's the pace of that, just the number of funds?
So it was quite, let's just call it quite crazy till about 2022. I think from the second half of 2022, we started to see a bit of a slowdown. And that coincides a little bit with just, you know, a market downturn. It also coincides with a lot of fund managers already having ESG strategies. So kind of a maturity in the market. And we think it's going to keep slowing there.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about kind of continued slowdown, because to me, it's almost more than sentiments about the makeup as well. And I'm wondering how much of the ESG ETF flow is really a function of regulation, yeah, as opposed to simply the makeup of the ETF.
And you're talking about the energy tech kind of dynamic.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you why I think flow slowed down. Now, it was a little bit because of performance, so as you mentioned, you know, the tech energy kind of thing. But in the US, what we really see last year is clean energy kind of plateaued a little bit and fell off its highs of 2020 and 2021. So that drop off, you could see it was quite significant. The second one is that, you know, like I said, ESG has grown to these large one-off allocations. And when those one-off allocations stop, it's very noticeable. So those didn't go out. They basically just flatlined a little bit. To me, was that performance? Was it, you know, just changes in allocation? Maybe someone didn't want, you know, something relating like an emerging market fund. So they sold off their EM emerging market funds. Things like that have happened. Whether it is ESG or not, we don't know.
All right, thank you so much for joining us. Shaheen Contractor, ESG analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. Coming up on the program, why M&A mania may continue in tech and pharma.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the Bloomberg Terminal. I'm Kriti Gupta.
I'm Paul Sweeney, and this is Bloomberg.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us Saturdays at noon Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
The high incidence of M&A in U.S. tech and pharma likely to continue as deals in real estate fall.
For more on why this is happening, we're joined by Bloomberg Intelligence government analyst Andrew Silverman. So, Andrew, talk to us about, you know, what we might see in the M&A space. What are some of the areas that you guys are looking for activity?
Well, so for the past 5 years, what we've been seeing is that tech and real estate and pharma deals have sort of outpaced everything else. And we don't expect that to change for tech and pharma. For real estate, maybe a different answer. But for tech and pharma, we expect that to continue. And the reason that we think that's the case is because we believe that government oversight of tech and pharma might not be as good as for other industries.
Well, that's kind of where I wanted to go to. I mean, you're a government policy analyst. You look at it from that perspective. Can stuff get done here? I mean, I'm seeing a lot of deals starting to get challenged by this Biden administration. And I wonder just overall, you know, what is the regulatory, what is the Washington view towards M&A?
Well, aggressive.
Yes.
They have been trying to crack down on deals that they find to be abusive. And they, in fact, think that some of these tech and pharma deals are abusive, but it's difficult for them to address these kinds of acquisitions, what academic folks have been calling killer acquisitions or kill zone acquisitions, because they don't really fall into the filters that the FTC and the DOJ have created for antitrust purposes to examine these transactions. And that's because they're so small. And normally, in the past, smaller transactions were seen to be sort of more immaterial. But the issue here is that in the tech and pharma space, intangibles, especially amongst startups, are where they derive most of their value
from. Right.
Right. And intangibles grow over time. If you capture them early, they don't have very much value, different than a tangible asset like a factory would have, because that has inherent value to begin with. But intangibles, not so much. It grows over time. So if you capture these things early on, you can take in the IP, and then that company can't grow and become a competitor 10, 15, 20 years.
It's like Facebook bought WhatsApp. That's one of my – you know, they have $22 billion for a couple of guys in a garage. But Zuckerberg knew what he was doing.
Totally.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah, and that's been the strategy. And it's difficult for the government to address these kinds of things because, first of all, there's just so many of those sorts of transactions, and also it takes a lot of sort of manpower and, you know, documentary review in order to get to the heart of some of these things. And in tax world, they've been trying to attack offshore income using the same sort of strategy, which is Louis Brandeis's theory, you know, sunshine is the best disinfectant. If you get a lot more documentation from companies, you can suss out where there's abuse. But the IRS hasn't been doing such a great job of managing all of the documents that they've been receiving. Like in 2019, they admitted that they destroyed 30 million documents unreviewed because they were unable to be put into their computer system, right? So my feeling is that even if the FTC and the DOJ are able to get the documents that they think they need to be able to address this, it's probably just too much for them. Even if they hire enough people, it's not going to be enough to actually address these kinds of transactions.
Paul points to Facebook. I like to point to Amazon and Whole Foods as my M&A deal that I remember most. But to me, I'm looking at research here. The line that really stands out to me is M&A filing fees in 2023 rose as much as 800%. We're still at the start of 2023, relatively. And it's interesting. It's not just about kind of these probes or investigations. There's an active disincentive here from a financial monetary point of view.
That's right. And it's not sort of a forthright thing that the government is doing, saying we don't want you to engage in these transactions. But when you take a filing fee and increase it 800% essentially overnight from 2022 to 2023, the message that you're giving the M&A space is you can do these things, but it's going to cost you.
Yeah.
So what does the government plan to do? What would they like to do to maybe get a better sense of kind of the what's really happening out there in terms of M&A and should company A be buying company B, that type of thing?
I think what they're trying to do is, without totally disrupting the M&A space, they're trying to find the transactions that are actually abusive. The issue is that the filters that they have, the theories that they're using to attack these things, are pretty old, right? I mean, Sherman Antitrust Act passed in 1890. At the time, the concern that they had was that companies were going to come together and make prices, you know, too high for consumers. That's not what tech and pharma companies are doing, right? They're doing something completely different that the framers of the Antitrust Act wouldn't have had in mind when they came up with the ideas.
How about real estate deals? You know, I look at commercial real estate, particularly here in Midtown Manhattan. It's empty. I mean, you know, people aren't working. We got 3 days a week here, 4 days a week there. I mean, I got to think that that is going to be an area where I'm not sure I want to be an M&A banker in real estate.
That's right. So even if the government doesn't seem to be attacking those sorts of deals like they're trying to do with Tech and Pharma, or they're actually doing with manufacturing these other sorts of deals, in the real estate space, we think the reason that these kinds of deals are going to fall off is because of working from home. And also, there's a tax angle, right? A lot of these transactions are engaged in by REITs, real estate investment trusts. And they were appealing when the corporate tax rate was 35%. Now that it's 21%, companies are thinking, well, right, does it really make sense for me to organize myself in the structure that's so costly to maintain and so difficult to manage when I could just operate as a corporation and, you know, suffer a 21% tax rate as opposed to, you know, whatever the REIT is suffering, which, you know, used to be pretty low, but now they have these corporations within them that raise the rate. It's not so different from 21%, right?
Well, the tax rate, sure, but then there's that work from home dynamic as well. How do you factor that in?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So I think that the fact that people are working more so from home means they're not obviously not coming into the office. That means that commercial real estate probably doesn't have as much value as it used to. Obviously, interest rates are going up as well. And so it's not like you point out, it's not just the REITs and the form of the entity that's acquiring these things that is an issue for real estate. But more broadly, society seems to be changing in the sense that people aren't coming to the office. So buildings aren't as valuable anymore.
Yeah, fascinating stuff from tech to pharma to real estate. Andrew Silverman covers it all on the M&A front. We thank him as always. Bloomberg Intelligence government analyst Andrew Silverman.
Coming up on the program, we'll discuss the push for equity traders to get more from algorithms.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Kriti Gupta.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. This is Bloomberg.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch the program Saturdays at noon Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the TuneIn app, Bloomberg.com, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analyst covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide. All right, the buy side is using more brokers for algorithmic trading and concentrating fewer orders with their top broker. For more on this, we're joined by Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Associate Market Structure Analyst Jackson Guttenplan. Jackson, thanks so much for joining us here. You know, when I was trading, my client would say, hey, go buy 600,000 shares of Union Pacific Railroad, and I'd go out and work it for an hour or two and get the deal done. That doesn't happen that much anymore, does it? Talk to us about kind of what you guys are seeing in algo trading, you know, in the marketplace these days.
Yeah, sure thing. So, that happens a little bit still. There might be some manual trading, but, for the most part, is a wide range of algorithm use. They're using a lot of different types of algorithms. They're diversifying the brokers that they're using. When we ran this buy-side study last year, we found our participants used about 6 algo brokers on average, and this year it's up to 9.
Okay.
And let's talk about the players here who are doing that. Goldman seems to be a no-brainer, but who else is here?
Yeah, so the top 6 stayed the same year over year. So we got Goldman, JP Morgan, Jefferies, Virtu, Bank of America. Who else am I forgetting? Morgan Stanley.
The big guys. I got you.
Yeah. You know the big guys. Yep. So what we found, Goldman came out on top. JP Morgan, really strong results in our survey as well. Between the two of them, each of them, over 40% of surveyed traders listed one of those two in their top 5 algo brokers. So that drove those two to the top of our, algo broker league tables. And then when we were looking at Goldman Sachs, it was a significantly more traders listing them as their number one broker. They skewed towards the larger guys that are going to generate more volume and more commissions. So our estimates was Goldman Sachs probably took home around 13% of the commission pool when it comes to algo trading.
So looking at the algo trading, it's become a big, big part of the business. I mean, if I'm a buy-side trader, a lot more of my trading is going to algos than it did 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. A huge driver of that is fragmentation in the market. There's so many venues out there, and the speed of trading is so much faster. To access all of this liquidity across 16 exchanges, 30 some odd ATS dark pools, and a litany of other single dealer platforms, you really need the help of computers to efficiently and effectively manage your flow.
It feels like everyone is saying that traditional trading is dead. At least when I was kind of first starting out my career, I really wanted to be a trader. And they're like, no, that's something you would do in like the 80s, the 90s. The assumption feels like eventually 100% of trading will be algo driven. How far away are we from that point?
The relationships between the buy side and the sell side is still really important. And I think that could be one driver that'll keep, some trades happening on the phone or via IB. In addition, sourcing block trades is still very manual. If there's a large trade, say over 10,000 shares that needs to be urgently done, the larger trades still may need attentive care, more attention from the sell side trading desk. But certainly, we're seeing a lot more flow going into algorithms, and it's allowing these trading desks to scale very effectively and handle more flow, as well as they could just plug into plug flow into their algorithms.
What's a customized algorithm?
Yeah, good question. We're seeing traders use customized algorithms more. So algorithms started, and now across the industry, they're pretty commoditized. You think of a VWAP algorithm or a TWAP algorithm. There's not a lot of difference across brokers, but now buy-side traders are really interested in, okay, let me make some small tweaks to those algorithms. Can I add in additional parameters? If I see these parameters of liquidity turn off these venues and turn on other venues, or switch from TWAP to VWAP if you see this in the market. And that's increasingly becoming popular. Talking to traders about this, they're pretty straightforward. They say, I love my customized algorithms because it does exactly what I want it to do.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be that simple.
What are the challenges then associated with those?
Yeah, so the challenges on the flip side, if you do get, adverse, condition or an outlier trade, these traders are having a really hard time analyzing these customized algorithms, doing TCA on this. Okay, why did that happen? I added 3 or 4 custom parameters, and I can't say whether this inefficient trade happened because of one or the other or some other market condition, and it adds a lot of confusion to their TCA.
All right, Jackson, good stuff. Really fascinating when you talk about the market structure of equity and fixed income markets. Jackson Guttenplan, he's a senior associate analyst covering market structure. Let's turn now to AI, artificial intelligence, where interest in the space is bringing new energy to cooling thematics. For more on AI and its disruption potential, we're joined by Bloomberg Intelligence strategist Brianne Doherty. Brianne, thanks so much for joining us. I had the first time we've chatted with you. Good stuff. Matt Miller and I on our show, we joke that if you ever want to just get a big pop in your multiple, just go on your earnings call and mention AI. I don't care if you make cupcakes. If you put AI in there, you're going to get a pop in your stock. What is artificial intelligence? How do you guys approach it from a thematic investing perspective?
I mean, you're right. We're hearing AI come up across earnings reports. I think we were even looking at the chatter as far as the news flow. Okay. And there was a huge surge in artificial intelligence mentions, obviously, in daily news. I think 2.7 times in a matter of 14 days, roughly. And then we're seeing that same sort of acceleration across earnings transcripts. Now, AI is a pretty broad topic, right? We see it emerge everywhere. You can think about applications in your own home, and then you can think about more scientific stuff and kind of where the tech is going. We look at it as something that we think is valuable to be defined here, and we look at it specifically as the utilize AI solutions such as deep learning, machine learning, natural language processing, and image and speech recognition. So that's really what we're focusing on. And then when we look at that focus, what we're seeing is that then has a breadth of coverage across software, services, hardware, semiconductors, and media. So it is pretty broad brush, but again, it's this idea that AI is actually going to have the potential to be disrupting several sectors actually progressively for the foreseeable future. So it's not that it's a one-stop disruption potential, but rather this AI tech, as it continues to evolve and accelerate, that you're going to see this continued disruption.
Well, Brianne, something else that Paul and Matt love on their show is individual stocks. Walk us through some of the names here that are perhaps outperforming with that AI story. I mean, there's your obvious ones, your Microsofts, your Alphabets, but walk us through the ones we're missing.
So NVIDIA, C3 AI, I mean, those have been really big movers off the back of AI. And they're a little bit more pure play specific. We haven't necessarily seen that same boost off of Microsoft necessarily or Alphabet. You know, not that they don't expect them to be big AI players, and they are. You know, Microsoft actually came out with a $10 billion participation deal that it's announcing around OpenAI, which is actually the biggest M&A deal that's been announced this quarter off the back of this AI rush. And so we are seeing those big players in it, but we're really looking, the ones that are really moving are some of these smaller guys with really, you know, purity of exposure to the AI theme.
How about the ETF space? You know, you bring a couple of hot buzzwords, ETFs, AI, you put them together. What's going on in the fund space, the ETF space, if I wanted to really get exposure to AI?
Yeah, so when we did our search across the ETFs out there that have artificial intelligence in their name, we came up with about 21. But, you know, there's 21 ETFs out there. What we've seen progressively, especially in thematics, is you'll see a concentration. And across those 21, you're capturing most of the AUM in about 7 ETFs. So over 84% of the AUM, roughly, or over 80% of the AUM being captured in 7 ETFs. And so what's interesting about that and the work that we did in our research was then we drilled down into those 7 ETFs. And while some of them that have some of the greatest AUM and have even seen some of the greatest inflow this far this quarter, actually, when we looked at it from a purity perspective, which is a metric we looked at where we looked at the actual revenue exposure to AI, as well as its representation and keyword searches across its disclosures, that we did find that while we saw something like Bots US getting a huge flow and obviously ranking high on the AUM side, it's from a purity perspective of those 7 biggest AUM representatives in the AI space, it was ranking last at the bottom of the ranks with respect to purity. So, you know, there's a lot of variance, and that just speaks to what happens in the space, right? Is that, one, it's going to be the nature of when maybe that ETF was constructed, the type of exposure it was constructed. Two, you're looking at thematics, and that's a pretty rapidly evolving space. Nascent technology is often captured in thematics, and these things can move, and people can choose to articulate the theme in many different ways. And so there's a fair amount of differentiation between ETFs that are capturing a similar theme.
And it feels like a really quick way to get your hands on AI is really just to kind of buy a smaller AI companies, which brings me to the topic of M&A and kind of the incentive that a lot of these tech companies who've been disincentivized from M&A from like a legislative and regulatory standpoint now have a new reason to do it.
again, in Q1, it's one of the bright spots that we've seen in the M&A market. It's not just the bright spot that we've seen in thematic ETFs. And we think that there's enough traction and enough momentum behind the growth of the tech and the potential development of the technology to really keep that M&A field alive and well. But let's also, you know, especially in the tech space, sometimes some M&A is more about narrowing the field of future competition. So what we're really watching closely is along these M&A trends, specifically targeting AI, is how much of that will come off the back of new revived growth versus how of it might actually kind of slow down the pace of development and lead us into a little bit more of a slower development field for AI tech itself as we go through this M&A.
How about thematic investing in general? I mean, thematic ETFs are really cool to me, but are they still kind of the flavor of the month in terms of gathering assets, or is thematic investing kind of lost its luster, particularly after maybe, I don't know, 2022 was a tough year for everybody, but.
Fair enough. I mean, I'm biased, right? This
okay.
is what I do for
this
a living.
This is what you do.
So I'm going to pitch it. I'm going to sell it. It is here to stay, okay. And I will remain employed.
So what? So again, AI is a great one. What else are you guys thinking about or in terms of thematic research?
I mean, we look at across. So what we have been seeing in thematic ETFs, and I think what's really important to realize is that there's been a cooling. You're absolutely right. There was a huge rush to it. I mean, growth was everywhere. You can jump into something. And it all felt very thrilling and exciting. There's been a cooling period. We've seen, you know, a net outflow. But again, our net outflow's been about 1%. That's pretty resilient when you think of how much growth was inherently, you know, captured within this thematic ETF sector or world.
And is it mostly technology driven? Like, I want to have exposure to AI or to EVs or to...
No, I mean, we've got natural resources are in there. Okay. So for instance, natural resources is one of the bright spots. It's where we've seen the most net inflow. So if you look down across thematic ETFs, we have seen a lot of inflow into thematic ETFs that have an energy exposure to them, for instance, right? And when we look at, for instance, like our baskets and the themes that we look at closely, we've got them venturing across wind, biofuels, nuclear, but we also have metaverse and AI, which we're going to be coming out with soon on. We've got electric vehicles. Like themes can really be quite, you know, capture a really big universe. What's important about them is that they're long-term compelling theses, right? This isn't something that you should be hopping in and out of. And even when we see these periods, so for instance, Future of Finance, our basket on Future of Finance, which is very much exposed to crypto blockchain, it's seen some pressure, right? It's had a little bit of pain through 2022. Do we still think crypto blockchain is going to be around and that there's applications for us in through future? Absolutely. I don't think anybody's denying it. People are acknowledging that there's evolutions that have to happen in these themes. And that's really what thematic investing is there for, right? That as these themes evolve, the baskets themselves, the funds themselves are evolving to capture how that theme is evolving. So bringing in the new players, acknowledging the fresh, you know, perspectives in the tech, and then driving forward with the acknowledgement that these are disruptive potentials long term. So the compelling long term theses and all of these themes very much intact. And sometimes what it is as we move through these cycles in the market, that you're going to see some fall further into favor and maybe some fall out of favor. It's natural ebbs and flows.
All right, Brianna, great stuff. Thank you very much for joining us. Brianna Doherty, she is a strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence. That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the Bloomberg Terminal. I'm Kriti Gupta.
And I'm Paul Sweeney, and this is Bloomberg.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.